Picture a shipping clerk in 1890s Belgium, standing at the docks of Antwerp, watching ships arrive from Africa. They come heavy with ivory and rubber, fortunes in raw materials. But when those same vessels return to the Congo, they carry no trade goods, no payment, nothing but guns and soldiers. For Edmond Dean Morrell, this arithmetic didn't add up to commerce. It added up to slavery on a scale the world had never seen. Between 1885 and 1908, approximately 10 million Congolese people died under the rule of King Leopold II of Belgium, a death toll rivaling the Holocaust, yet one that remains largely forgotten. What makes this tragedy particularly chilling is its architect, a European monarch who never set foot in the Congo, who orchestrated genocide from ornate palaces thousands of miles away, and who convinced the world he was engaged in humanitarian work. This wasn't the chaotic brutality of warlords. This was industrialized exploitation dressed in the language of civilization, complete with international treaties and charitable foundations. The story reveals not just one man's monstrous greed, but how easily the world can be convinced to look away from suffering when profit and power are at stake. Before Europeans arrived, the Kingdom of the Congo thrived along the river's mouth, a sophisticated federation of millions with its own currency, skilled metalworking, and elaborate governance. When Portuguese explorer Diogo Cao arrived in 1482, he encountered not savages, but civilization. The Congolese called these pale strangers Vumbi, spirits of the dead, because their beliefs held that skin turned chalk white after death. These spirits brought an insatiable appetite for human cargo. King Afonso I, ruling from 1506, converted to Christianity and engaged Europeans as equals. His letters chronicle his kingdom's destruction. Each day, the traitors are kidnapping our people, children of this country, sons of our nobles and vassals, even people of our own family. The Portuguese transformed limited African slave trade into an engine of depopulation for New World plantations. Henry Morton Stanley was born John Rowlands in Wales, abandoned, workhouse-raised, reinvented in America with an elaborate fictional backstory. He excelled at violence packaged as adventure. His 1874 to 1877 expedition across Central Africa left hundreds dead in dozens of destroyed villages. Stanley's real discovery was geographical. The Congo River's massive counterclockwise arc created a 1,000-mile stretch of navigable water, a natural highway into Africa's interior. This wasn't just a river, it was an economic lifeline waiting to be exploited by his next patron, a calculating Belgian king who saw in Stanley's maps the blueprint for empire. Leopold II inherited Belgium's throne in 1865, but it felt like a cage. His loveless childhood, where siblings were favored and he needed appointments to see his father, left deep scars. His arranged marriage to 16-year-old Archduchess Marie Henriette was a disaster from the honeymoon. She escaped into horseback riding, he escaped into maps and dreams of empire. Unlike other European monarchs who cloaked colonialism in Christianity or civilization, Leopold was refreshingly honest. Colonies existed to make him rich and grant him absolute power beyond Belgium's parliamentary constraints. He investigated possibilities everywhere, Argentina, Fiji, Borneo, searching for his personal kingdom. In 1876, Leopold hosted a grand geographical conference in Brussels, forming the International African Association and presenting it as purely philanthropic. Like a theatrical producer, he had organizational talent, public goodwill, and royal prestige, but still needed a stage and a leading man. When Stanley emerged from Africa in 1877, Leopold found both. After Stanley's disappointing London reception, he agreed to work for Leopold for 5 years, establishing bases, building roads, and transporting steamboats upriver. They were perfectly matched. Stanley seeking upward mobility through African adventure, Leopold seeking to multiply his fortune. What neither man cared about were the 20 million Africans whose lives would be consumed by their ambitions. Leopold's genius lay in deception. He created multiple organizations with deliberately confusing names: the International African Association, the Committee for Studies of the Upper Congo, the International Association of the Congo, all using the same gold star on blue flag. To Americans, he promised free Negro republics. To Europeans, free cities. To humanitarians, a society of the Red Cross serving progress. Nobody noticed these contradictory promises or that Leopold controlled everything personally. His first target was the United States. He deployed Henry Shelton Sanford, a failed businessman whose general title came from donating cannon during the Civil War. Sanford's unexpected ally was Senator John Tyler Morden of Alabama, who saw Leopold's Congo as the perfect destination for America's black population, a solution to the South's Negro problem. On April 22, 1884, the United States became the first country to recognize Leopold's claim. The Secretary of State deliberately confused Leopold's private International Association of the Congo with his defunct philanthropic International African Association. European powers followed. The 1884 Berlin Conference, where European nations divided Africa without a single African present, legitimized Leopold's claim. In May 1885, Leopold named his territory the Congo Free State, 76 times larger than Belgium. One man now owned a territory the size of Western Europe. For years, Leopold's Congo drained his fortune, until John Dunlop's 1890 invention of the inflatable rubber tire changed everything. The worldwide rubber boom transformed the Congo into Africa's most profitable colony, with profit margins reaching 700%. Wild rubber vines grew throughout the rainforest, and Leopold demanded ever-increasing quantities. Since Congolese people naturally resisted this backbreaking labor, often spending 24 days monthly in the forest, they had to be compelled through terror. Hostage-taking became standard practice. Women, children, elders, or chiefs were held in stockades until rubber quotas were met. The most horrifying practice was the severing of hands. When villages resisted, soldiers would shoot residents and collect right hands as proof they hadn't wasted bullets. William Shepherd, a black American missionary, discovered 81 smoked hands in the marauders' camp. Leopold kept the Congo's enormous profitability secret, grossly understating profits to avoid repaying Belgium's loans. Instead, he spent his fortune on monuments, palace wings, museums, and pavilions across Belgium, a royal gift to his people, built on Congolese bones. George Washington Williams, a Civil War veteran turned minister, lawyer, and historian, became the first great dissenter. After traveling to the Congo in 1890, he documented atrocities in an open letter to King Leopold that used crimes against humanity decades before Nuremberg. Leopold's smear campaign followed, and Williams died in 1891 at 41 in an unmarked grave, though virtually everything he wrote was later corroborated. Joseph Conrad's 1890 journey up the Congo River profoundly disillusioned him. 8 years later, he transformed these experiences into Heart of Darkness. The novel's villain appears modeled on Captain Leon Rom, who decorated his flowerbed with 21 severed African heads, just as Kurtz displays heads on poles. The most formidable opponent emerged from the shipping docks, Edmond Dene Morel, the young clerk who'd noticed the arithmetic of slavery, abandoned his career to become Britain's greatest investigative journalist. Unlike humanitarian groups who merely condemned atrocities, Morel argued Leopold's entire state was systematically founded on slave labor. Banned from visiting Congo, he became the clearinghouse for leaked documents, publishing 3 books, hundreds of articles, and dozens of pamphlets, writing 3,700 letters in just 6 months of 1906. Baptist missionaries John and Alice Harris proved his most effective spokespeople, speaking at 600 events in 2 years while displaying whips and shackles. The campaign spread to America, where Mark Twain wrote King Leopold's soliloquy, donating all royalties. British consul Roger Casement's 1903 investigation documented villages with decimated populations, severed hands, and hostages held for rubber quotas. His meeting with Morrell proved transformative. They spend hours sharing complimentary evidence. With pressure mounting, Leopold sold the Congo to Belgium in 1908, extracting an estimated $1.1 billion in today's dollars. Just before transfer, palace furnaces burned for 8 days, reducing most records to ash. "I will give them my Congo," Leopold told his aide, "but they have no right to know what I did there." He died the following year, little mourned. Belgium systematically erased Congo's atrocities through document destruction and collective forgetting. When Germany invaded Belgium in 1914, killing over 5,000 civilians, brave little Belgium became a symbol of suffering. No one recalled that a decade earlier, the King of the Belgians had ordered hands cut off in Africa. Colonizers controlled memory through textbooks praising Leopold's most humanitarian campaign of the century, press censorship and book banning. While village lore survived, in Mongo, to send someone to harvest rubber means to tyrannize, collective memory remained scanty. At independence in 1960, Congo had fewer than 30 university graduates and only 3 Africans in management positions. When Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba sought Soviet help, the U.S. authorized his assassination. Joseph Mobutu, who received CIA payments while planning the murder, staged a U.S.-backed coup in 1965. Ruling for over 30 years, Mobutu resembled Leopold, one-man rule, appropriating state assets as personal property. The reform movement left 2 achievements, documenting extensive proof of atrocities and keeping alive humanity's capacity for outrage at distant suffering. The story remains urgently relevant. Atrocities don't require monsters, just ordinary people profiting from distant suffering, and the rest of us willing to look away. The question is, what arithmetic aren't we adding up? What ships are we watching without asking what they truly carry?